Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Jeff Johnson in for Roland Martin. Just ahead on News One Now, the results are in for the Iowa caucuses. We talk to the voters, big decisions, and what it means for the rest of the presidential election. And hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons visits the residents of Flint, Michigan, and vows that he and his celebrity friends will donate millions of bottles of water. A Republican lawmaker in Georgia has pulled his name from a controversial legislation after receiving backlash from the comments he made publicly about supporting the Klan. There's a brutal raid in Nigeria. Nigeria Islamic extremists are being blamed for a deadly attack that left a village burnt to the ground, dozens dead, including children. News One Now starts right now.
Tonight is a victory for courageous conservatives across Iowa and all across this great nation.
We finished second, and I want to tell you something. I'm just honored. I'm really honored.
When I am a nominee, we will unite our party, we will grow our party, and we will defeat Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or whoever they nominate.
This is a national campaign. We are in this to win at the convention. We're taking this all of the way.
So as I stand here tonight, breathing a big sigh of relief, thank you, Iowa.
There were a lot of twists and turns last night with the Iowa caucuses. Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders ended in a virtual tie, and Senator Ted Cruz topped the GOP lineup. Here's a look at the numbers. Clinton received 49% of the vote. Sanders received 49% of the vote. 6% of the vote. Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley failed to even get one full percentage point and didn't drop out of the race, but suspended his campaign. As for Republican Senator Ted Cruz, won with just shy of 28% of the vote. Donald Trump and Senator Mark Rubio were right behind him with 24% and 23%. Ben Carson came in fourth with about 9% of the vote. Mike Huckabee has dropped out of the race on the Republican side. Now let's talk about what all of this means for the rest of the election season and really about our community as well. Joining me on Skype in Des Moines, Iowa is Dana Boone. She attended the caucuses last night as editor-in-chief of Epiphany365.com. And on the panel, Giano Caldwell, Republican strategist, Dr. Julianne Malveaux, President Emerita, Bennett College, and David Swerdlick, assistant editor for The Washington Post. Thank you all for joining me.
Good to be here, Jeff.
Right. Always good to be with you. So let me go to Skype first because I want to talk to Dana about what she saw happening last night and the feel. I mean, there's a whole lot of conversation about what Iowa really means. And first of all, for you to be a black woman in Iowa is an anomaly. So what was it like? Number one, what did you see last night that was not reported? And what do the electorate that's going to be making some decisions very soon, what should they know that they would not see on the news last night?
Well, for one, the people who attended the caucuses were, you know, the excitement was really lacking on the Clinton side of things. Bernie Sanders supporters were pretty fired up, but a lot of people willing to be very thoughtful and intentional about vetting these candidates and, you know, doing their part to move this process along and help set the bar for the rest of the country, really, when it comes to this race.
Thank you. I also want to make sure that we recognize joining us is Dr. Greg Carr. He's a chair for Howard University's Department of Afro-American Studies and probably the most popular professor at Howard University. He would never say that, though. So let's talk a little bit about this. I mean, let's start with the Democrats, if we can. We've got a 50-50 dead heat. In fact, as of this morning, they were still a little bit uncomfortable with saying who the actual winner was. Who is this better for? Who does this dead heat serve? deserve better.
Well, my headline is the DNC and Hillary Clinton loses big. I spoke with Simone Sanders, the national press secretary for Bernie Sanders' campaign. They feel very, very good about the results that came out there. Obviously, still waiting to see who actually won this virtual tie, but they feel very good about it. At the end of the day, the Clintons should have won this thing outright. You got a guy who's a democratic socialist who has ideas that may be popular among the youth, but people don't think of them as realistic things to get done in Congress.
But Dr. Marvell, let me, because you know you try to moderate from over there. Let me do this real quick. Let me ask you a question. So really, this really should have been Bernie's state, though. I mean, this is an incredibly progressive state. This is a state that played to his strengths. Is this really a victory for their campaign, or does it show that Hillary had a last-minute surge?
You know, Hillary did Iowa in 2008, and she blugged Iowa in 2008. She knows Iowa, and she blew it. Quite frankly, the one-on-one makes Bernie Sanders gives him wings.
Yes.
My Republican brother here is going to do his thing because that's what they do.
The truth is, honey, the fact that a lie will die. She should have won.
But here's the bottom line.
It would have been a decisive win.
Here's the bottom line.
Give me the bottom line.
We know that this is going to be a contest.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary doesn't
now
get it.
It will be.
She never was going to get it. Mm-hmm. She was never going to get it when Bernie Sanders walked in. This was really the stealth Elizabeth Warren campaign.
Wow.
And that's a name that has not been raised.
I haven't heard that in
Let me just say
one thing about this, Jeff, and I agree with you, Dr. J, about the Elizabeth Warren aspect. I agree with Gianno about the fact that this was not a great night, at least, maybe not even a good night for Clinton. The only thing I'll say is I read an interesting analysis by Nate Cohn of the New York Times early this morning, who was saying, look, Sanders did well in Iowa. He will probably do well, if not win New Hampshire, but he only has to focus on those two states. Once you go nationwide, Hillary Clinton has the better network, more money, and more moderate voters,
David,
especially in the South, that are going to help propel her.
The other piece of this is that this is an example of structural racism. How dare we allow these two white states to set the tone for what is happening around this election.
But what's interesting, and I want to bring in Dr. Carr, but about the
implicit structural racism called a couple. Ruth Marcus did a piece today.
Let me come in real quick because I want to bring you in, Dr. Carr. Can I shift here so we can have some conversation? I want to be clear though, because I think Dr. Marvell's point is a good one, but I think historically we also have clearly seen that South Carolina always plays an important pivot point.
Oh, absolutely.
In this primary season. So as real as the structural racism is, what does this mean, especially for black voters, as you begin to see us go from a launch from New Hampshire into South Carolina?
Absolutely. Well, you're talking about, 3% black people in Iowa. So, but Iowa or New Hampshire hasn't picked a president consistently in very many years.
1%.
Absolutely. I mean, it's about narratives. We're spinning narratives. Yes. I mean, 10 days from now, we're not going to be talking about this in the same way. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been around for a long time. He's been playing that one-note samba for years. Remember his filibuster a couple of years ago, and nobody watched it. I'm sitting on C-SPAN. I'm watching like, wow, is anybody watching this? Nobody's watching it. But I guess what I'm saying is that, whether or not Hillary Clinton came in first or second yesterday is probably going to be irrelevant within the next month. When we hit that first cluster of major states, I think the Ted Cruz phenomenon begins to evaporate. They're betting a lot of money on Marco Rubio, who doesn't have a whole lot of ideas and is in some ways trying to steal a page book from Barack Obama. Be a Rosarch test, and who are you? Who do you say I am? Well, that probably won't work in the South in the same way. We're going to hear a lot more from Donald Trump. I believe in about a week from now, we're going to be, in fact, probably closer to the narrative we were yesterday than we are.
Well, let's talk about the Republicans a little bit. We saw that Ted Cruz got 27% of the vote. As much as Donald Trump likes to say he was blessed that he got in second, we know he doesn't like that at all. What I'm wondering is this, though. As you go into New Hampshire, are we going to begin to see some different players? Is Rubio going to surge even more? more. And what do you all make of the New York Times article about Kasich? So does Kasich become a dark horse as the electorate starts to get a little bit more reasonable than we've seen them leading into Iowa?
I think that it's absolutely possible that he becomes a dark horse. At the end of the day, when it came to debates, he was more the more reasonable and moderate Republicans that we've seen on stage. In terms of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, my headline would be, Trump loses to a guy born in another country. That's pretty much what it is at the end of the day. Donald Trump, in any normal situation, he should have been the guy to win this. He's talked about he could shoot someone and still win, his poll numbers would go up, but none of that happened yesterday.
He also said, what did he say? He said that if he did not win, that he had lost. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had.
There was a tweet that years ago he said, nobody is good in second place. Who cares about second place? At the end of the day, he was an outside candidate. Just two days ago, he said that his loss would be his loss to Iowa.
He called Iowans stupid. I don't even deal with those people. I just really don't deal with those people because it's just not worth it. But what I would say, Jeff, is when we look at some of this, what we have to look at is where our country is heading. And I would yield to our political science professor in terms of looking at the ways that people have chosen to act out, but also the flaws in Iowa. Mm-hmm. They close the doors at a certain point in time. If you work at night, you're not in it.
Yeah, and let's be honest. I mean, we know that Iowa is a political anomaly, and it's a throwback to a day that is over and done with. What I mean by that, it's political theater more than it's political barometer. So, because I want us to talk about Flynn a little bit, and I want us to talk about
Flynn.
As these candidates are looking at what issues are important, are we going to see folks coming into Flint, and what is that going to mean as the black electorate starts to be engaged or not engaged?
I don't think the black electorate is going to be engaged, quite frankly. I think that it was engaged the last two national election cycles because of Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And I think that Hillary Clinton is relying on a demographic that may not show up for her. Maybe the over 40 crowd will.
Yeah.
But when you look at the younger audience, I think probably of the people, Hillary Clinton will have some very pragmatic things to say about addressing the Flint crisis. This isn't about bottled water. This is about structural racism and repairing it.
Yeah.
Now, Bernie Sanders will also talk about jobs. I mean, Michael Moore will probably show up and join Cornel West for a swing through Michigan. But where does Michigan fall in the primary states? Where does it fall in the cluster?
Yeah.
And, I mean, finally, you mentioned John Kasich, who I think is probably, as you say, the most sensible person in the Republican field. Is this really about money? And I will yield to you all, because it seems to me that money drives this. Do the money people come up and tell Kasich and the rest of these cats, y'all got to clear the field?
And you know, Doc, the challenging thing about Flint is this. It's really about a national denouement of infrastructure.
Yes.
In other words, we're not talking about Flint. We're talking about Washington, D.C. We're talking about Chicago. Mm-hmm. We're talking about cities around the country. We're talking about, Jeff, places where, bridges are
structural.
Basically,
yeah.
Right. And the American Association of Civic Engineers has given our country like a D.
But let's be honest, because David, this isn't just about structural decay. This is about legitimate maneuvering by politicians to try to save money at the cost of the lives of its citizens, and then lying about it, and then failing to educate the people. So while there is legitimate public infrastructure decay here, this is one of the questions when I was in Flint yesterday, and we're going to talk about this going into the next segment, is who's going to jail?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do these candidates begin to speak to that issue in addition to the real structural issues?
Three points, Jeff. One, right. Governor Snyder, Republican governor of Michigan, he broke the first do no harm rule when he had his manager change the water source for Flint. And that led down the road to where we are now. There are other people who share some of the blame, but I think this is the core of the blame. To Professor Carr's point about the candidates and the race, you have Republicans missing an opportunity here to try and get the supposed support that they so crave from voters of color. This is an issue. This is low-hanging fruit for them, and they disregarded it totally, partly because of the reason you stated. Michigan is nowhere near up in the election cycle. When you're campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire, there's no incentive.
And I want you to hold your third point, because we're going to be right back when we talk pastors from around the country. We're in Flint with myself and others. And really, it was an unbelievable time. I think we want to talk about where these leaders are going, what the local issues are, what the demands are, and how a broader community supports it and challenges politicians to do the same thing. Stay right there. It's 14 after the hour. We'll be right back with more News One Now.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Our coverage of the water crisis in Flint, Michigan continues this morning. Pastors from across the country gathered in Flint yesterday for what's been dubbed as the Environmental Justice Rally for Flint. I was there along with several other concerned members of our community, including attorney Ben Crump, hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons, and others. So the rally was held at the First Trinity Missionary Baptist Church, where Reverend Ezra Tillman Jr. serves as pastor. And he joins us live via Skype this morning with an update from yesterday's event in Flint, Michigan. Pastor, good to see you again this morning, sir.
Good morning. This morning, it was a pleasure to meet you, sir.
So let's talk a little bit about one. I think that one of the most important things that we saw was the local leadership having such an important role in not only putting together an event, but leading for the last 2 years. Talk a little bit about how it felt to have national leadership not come in and try to take over, but support the work you'd already done and set the stage for what's next.
I think that was very, very respectful and tactful, considering those ground workers have to be here once these national leaders leave. And you want to make sure that with any encouragement you get, you want someone to support and to push your agenda so it's not lost. I think sometimes it's a tragedy about it. We have our annual days, we have our particular events, and it shifts from the true work. And I think really the way Dr. Jamal and some of the others came in, they really pushed the agenda that was on the floor to keep the work going, keep people pushing, keep people speaking concerning what are the issues before us.
And talk a little bit about that, because there are multiple levels of work that need to be done. You've got water needs by way of the bottled water, but you all are dealing with structural issues, and you're also dealing with a class action lawsuit. For those folks that weren't there yesterday and those that are looking to be supportive in the long term, what are the issues that you all are focusing on in this wave of the work?
The main issue I believe that's pressing is, will the governor give a plan, give some responsibility, and show some action concerning his statement of saying, I'm sorry, I'm going to show you, I'm going to do something about it. I believe many of the fear of those who are watching or being affected by this is that it's going to be the way it's always been. And yesterday was the apex to see, okay, we're going to have America to look at us, but what's going to happen next? What's going to follow? Will we truly get some type of support, some type of federal investigation, something that's going to be pressing to say, listen, you have to do something? I believe that's the fear really in people's hearts and minds. And that's really the tragedy about in the city, is that you get used to being oppressed and you just live with it.
So with that, and before I let you go, there again are people all over the country, and there are folks from, corporate leaders and entertainers, regular activists, church folks that are saying, I want to know how I can be involved in Flint outside of putting pallets of water on a truck and sending it into Flint. What is your leadership group saying is how support should be brought into the city at this point?
Right now, there's so much fog around how the federal is going to follow, how the government is going to give support to the situation. Everything's kind of really up. There's a lot of hearsay. But most of all, I believe that my personal conviction is someone needs to press our Senate and other officers to say, listen, we know what's going on. We're going to call. We're going to be continually on this particular case until the water is better. There's so much deception is done. There's so much lack of integrity that's been given towards the situation from leadership. It leaves us really at a crisis because the water is worse than what has been reported. A lot of lies, a lot of covers up, a lot of backdoor deals have been done in between. It's a very scary situation, and I don't believe it's going away anytime soon. And so many lives are still at risk. And we didn't even mention yesterday how many lives have been lost because of the condition of this water.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Tillman, I want to thank you for your time and thank you for the work that you're doing there. We really appreciate you joining us this morning.
Yes, sir. Thank you so very much, man. Keep on doing what you're doing.
Yes, sir. So Doc, let me bring you in on this, because there are all these comparisons to Tuskegee when we start talking about Flint. And I think Reverend Tillman even pointed to the fact that you're hearing two things out of this governor's mouth. At what point do those of us on the outside, how do they engage the political side of this, whether it's around supporting the class action movement or, frankly, around pushing from the external to call for a recall of this governor?
You know, Jeff, let's go back to 2010 when the United Nations asserted that the right to clean water was a human right. Right to clean water. We're talking about a billion people in the world who don't have access to clean water, but 100,000 of them are in Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so while we call ourselves, you know, this world leader, what we've allowed to have happen is that these people in Flint, Michigan have been sidelined from a basic human right. Rick Snyder needs to be put up under the jail, up under the jail. He knows what he did, and his tepid apology is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. But more than that, what is unacceptable is the denouement of the infrastructure of our nation's water, bridges, and all of that. And who pays the most? Those who have the least. And they are people of African, and they're poor people. And so what we need, Reverend Tillman is a hero, and you were, for being there. And we need to begin to have conversations about who in this darn Congress has any responsibility for allowing a city to live like a developing country.
Well, and David, because I cut you off before you ended your third piece, but I want you to build on this a little bit, because I think Doc's point is interesting, but the reality is this is not a sub-Saharan African nation that actually doesn't have access to water. This is about a city that under the management of appointed by a governor, who that governor was responsible for, shifted the sources of water to save 15 cents. Then in the midst of studies that showed that the water was unsafe, falsified those numbers to show that, it was less safe.
One second, Doc. He's done this in city after city after city in Michigan.
And yes. Exactly. And so my point is, as much as we would like to say this is an access issue, this is an issue of political disruption. Yeah,
political decisions were made,
yes.
Right. To your point, right, you talked about in 2010 the UN said water was a human right. Also in 2010 is when we saw the rise of the Tea Party. And one of the central messages was fiscal responsibility. And one of the things that was an outgrowth of that was this idea that cities were, you know, again, I'm talking about Republican strategy writ large. Governor Snyder came in into several cities, as you said, and said, look, we're going to take over management of your cities because you're wasting money.
And only certain kind of cities.
Kind of cities. But here's the crazy thing about it, though. There's always been this discussion throughout this time period we're talking about how much government there should be, whether
the first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two,
the way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can't do it, no excuses after that.
We are your centerpiece for Black Thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
But I am saying that that they had clean water and they created a problem where there was no problem.
Yes, he did. Okay. Because it also dealt with the issue of Detroit. Right. Let's not only
That's
talk about Flint.
About.
Yes.
Let's talk about Detroit. Let's talk about the fact that this governor deliberately, unfortunately our president also deliberately, dealt with the denouement of Detroit, and it was connected to Flint.
No, very much so, because this was about control of the water, and at the end of the day, Flint was the largest consumer of that water,
right.
And as a result, they wanted to shift this to remove Detroit as a factor in the water control and supply and revenue of the state.
And essentially say that Detroit was not going to have the dollars.
Right.
So it was a way to basically throw Detroit under the bus.
Right.
even as Detroit was providing.
But what you said in the midst of that is that Snyder is committing genocide.
Yes.
And so I want you to respond to that.
So what you all said is he took over certain cities. Well, Flint was going into bankruptcy. So it was a need to take over Flint. Now this is what I have issue with. Now, yeah. So this is the point.
Black people managing their own city, right?
Yeah.
Because it isn't just Republicans, it isn't just Democrats. This goes back to after the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. When you start talking about people exercising the franchise, right, you begin to see across this country, whether it be the takeover of the Newark public schools in New Jersey, the Philadelphia public schools in Pennsylvania, as black people exert, and poor people for that matter, political control, it expands out. Michigan has a history that. You go back to Milliken versus Bradley, brother, when you start talking about busing. No,
no, no,
let's
be very clear.
When you start talking about race.
I get it.
But 6% were black.
But again,
9,000 black children.
They took a 15 million dollar savings.
Black children.
Make that point.
Have been infected. Essentially infected. Have had their total lives.
The rest of their
lives.
That's right.
And their lives. So don't even go there, bro.
Don't go there.
Let's be clear. 9,000 black children.
Before you all continue, because this is not a conversation that can end right now, though this one will. Mm-hmm. And as we move forward, there's going to be a whole lot of conversation about not only the health risks that are happening as a result of this and the long-term funds that have to be there, but the short, medium, and long-term strategy all of us are going to have to be involved in if we're serious about it. You know, members of the radical Islamic group Boko Haram are being blamed for another tragedy in Nigeria. This time the group is accused of burning children alive as a part of an assault on a village in northeastern Nigeria. They reportedly left 86 people dead. Dozens of homes were burned to the ground. Children were abducted and carried off into the bush. And people seeking refuge under a tree were blown up by a suicide bomber who had infiltrated their ranks. One witness said the nighttime attack lasted for hours. Boko Haram has marauded across northern Nigeria for years in crimes that came long before the group declared allegiance to the Islamic State last year. Nigeria's six-year Islamic uprising has killed about 20,000 people and driven 2.5 million from their homes. Coming up, you all, some of our future leaders have a few words about Stacey Dash. Yeah, we'll be right back. More on News One Now.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
A Republican lawmaker from Georgia criticized for saying the Ku Klux Klan was not racist. Yes. Has now withdrawn his name from several bills he sponsored to honor the Confederacy. Georgia State Representative Thomas Benton came under fire after his comments about slavery and the Ku Klux Klan gained national attention.
The idea that slavery was the cause of the war, it wasn't. That the Southern states seceded because the North was advocating doing away with slavery, but they offered no idea as to what the South would do with a loss of $2 billion worth of property, per se. And I understand that African Americans, for the most part, have a problem with the slavery issue, but they don't denounce their ancestors that were in Africa that were selling slaves. It was not just based on race as such. It was based on I guess you'd call them vigilantes.
Georgia State Senator Republican Josh McCown was quick to condemn the remarks.
Recent comments made by a member of this General Assembly regarding the Ku Klux Klan. The comments made are contemptible. They're wrong, and they deserve the strongest possible public condemnation. In 2016, one would hope we would not even have to have this discussion. The Klan was the original domestic terrorist organization. There is simply no excusing the murderous, terroristic campaign they waged against Americans. I hope that the author of these comments will reconsider them and apologize for them. It has been my experience that none of my fellow colleagues feel the same as that member.
Benton did not apologize or retract his statements. He will retain his chairmanship of the House Committee on Human Relations and Aging. Wow. But there is now a call for Benton to be removed from that position. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, a petition reads in part, quote, Speaker Railston, we urge you to denounce Rep. Tommy Benton's defense of the Ku Klux Klan, block Representative Benson, neo-Confederate bills, and remove him from his role as chair of the Human Relations and Aging Committee. Benton's defense of the KKK and his backwards views on slavery make it clear that he does not represent the people of Georgia, end quote. Joining me via Skype is Georgia State NAACP President Francis Johnson. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Good morning, Brother Johnson.
How are you? So let's get right into this. There is clearly enough movement to denounce this representative's out-of-touch statements. The question really is, what happens next? And is this just a larger clarion call for those of you in Georgia and other places to be more aggressive about midterm elections?
Well, you know, in a real sense, there's something missing from the coverage of this story. Hmm. His statements were made last Wednesday, and there was a deafening silence throughout the chambers of our General Assembly under what we call the Golden Dome in Atlanta. The governor was silent, the lieutenant governor, the speaker of the House was silent, and most of the Republican extremists who supported this legislation and who also support the ideas behind the legislation were silent. This was simply a bridge too far in this hyper-political and divisive season of presidential candidates who are knocking themselves over to offend the next group. They believed they were going to get away with this. Mm-hmm. And what were they trying to do? To amend the Constitution to provide greater protections to the largest Confederate monument in this world, Stone Mountain, more protections than we give to citizens who are dying here in the street. What were they trying to do? To enshrine Robert E. Lee, a birthday on Martin Luther King Day, and they were trying to have a whole month, the month of April, for Confederate Memorial Day.
So what does that mean by way of what happens next? Because clearly there's a move to silence this one lawmaker, but what does that mean for the culture that you're clearly talking about that permeates your state legislature?
Absolutely. Well, you know, we who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Those in the NAACP and across progressive organizations, we have to fight every single day.
And what does that fight look like? What does that look like?
That fight looks like direct action, meaning that we have to keep people down at the legislature to watch for not just these types of bills, but also bills to erode voting rights, to roll back early voting, to eliminate Sunday voting here in Georgia. That means that we have to have a litigation strategy. And right now we have 7 federal lawsuits either filed or either pending filing in the coming days that all deal with Georgia's voting apparatus as we approach the first election in 50 years. We won't have the protections of the Voting Rights Act. And it also means that we've got to have public policy advocacy discussions and debates, not just with our own groups who agree with us, but with the other side. And there is space on the other side for folks who realize we can't continue to fight a war that was lost 150 years ago.
Well, and Dr. Carr, let's talk about that, because there's this constant conversation about the Confederacy being part of our history. But there's a reality that it was a foreign army that was defeated. And so when we start talking about narratives and dealing with history in an accurate way, at what point do we start really being clear about the narrative about this isn't about offensive or not? There is no precedent for the United States flying the flag of an enemy it's defeated. Ever.
I mean, you know,
honoring its soldiers.
The Confederate battle flag is integrated into the state flags of most of the Confederate states. Yeah. And Confederate history is American history. And I think what we have to understand is the only reason we're having this conversation is because the demographic in this country is changing. We would not be having it otherwise. This representative saw what happened in South Carolina. He's trying to get out in front of it. Stone Mountain is the Confederate Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who don't have any problem with that. If they had, this would have been a problem years ago. And what this brother has said is absolutely correct.
But this was a problem years ago. Since 1915, the NAACP and other groups have been fighting against these sorts of veterans.
Over Thanksgiving 1915 was the birth of the modern Ku Klux Klan. On the top of Stone Mountain, Georgia, a burning cross and an open Bible, they revived the Klan. But let's be very clear. We're talking about this as if the Confederacy was somehow an enemy of the United States. Remember, Lincoln fought the Civil War to save the Union. He said, if I have to free them or not, I'm trying to preserve the Union. Ultimately, the Confederacy will only be confronted by those who are its direct victims. The tragedy in this country is the vast silence around this question of white supremacy.
The challenge is that when you look at, for example, the ways that we've embraced what happened with the Holocaust, we have never embraced the fact that the South lost. They lost.
On the field. And culturally, it looks like they won.
But you know, I have a godchild who came up in Georgia. Mm-hmm. I have an Atlanta family. If you go and look at what happens in the schools, and my brother from the NAACP, I'm sure will affirm me, they try to make this like they won.
And they will. I want to do this because we got to pay some bills. We're going to come up and roll in and his entertainment panel breakdown that will give their predictions on who they think is going to win big at the NAACP Image Awards, countering some of this other imaging that we're seeing. For the latest news, stay up to date and informed at News One. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Jeff's Nation or at News One or our News One Facebook page. It's 40 after the hour, you all. We'll be right back.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Stacey Dash continues to take heat for her comments about Black History Month.
I don't think so, no. Just like this shouldn't be a Black History Month. You know, we're Americans, period. That's it.
What? Excuse me? What did she just say? Oh my God. Is that even legal?
That don't make any sense.
Does Kanye want to know about this?
Black History Month is our turn
to acknowledge our strength,
our accomplishments,
and our contributions,
and our beauty.
It forces us to talk about our amazing history.
And it didn't begin with slavery.
No negativity, no stereotypes.
All excellence.
Because that's who and what we are.
We're not canceling anything.
So you have to rock with us for 29 days.
It's a celebration.
It's Black History Month.
That is my favorite commercial in the history of commercials.
Yeah, that's good. That's
so 2016 cool. Is the 19th anniversary of celebrating Black History in February in this country, with all of the discussion about the relevance of Black History Month, campaigns like Because of Them We Can, and Black Studies curricula in colleges and universities are ever more important. Our next guest has a featured piece in Ebony Magazine. Is one of my favorite professors, Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. And remaining on the panel are Dr. Julian Malvo, David Swerdlick, and Gianno Caldwell. Doc.
Yes, sir.
So I'm sure it frustrates you to even have to write that kind of piece in 2016.
Sure.
But break down for us. When Carter G. Woodson created Negro History Week in 1927, mm-hmm. he was not insulting us to say that this was the only time that we should study or share our history. Give us some context on where he was in 27.
Woodson, well, you know, Woodson was born to formerly enslaved parents. He worked in a coal mine until he was 22 years old so he could finish high school. This brother invented Negro History Week the second week in February. He put it there because it was the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln on the 12th, and Frederick Douglass, who in a great act of American history picked his own birthday, February 14th. He picked Valentine's Day. He said, but this is the short period of time when we review and celebrate what we have learned about the study of the Negro the entire year. Remember, he's talking about a network of segregated schools. Woodson created institutions to emphasize the study of Black people for two reasons. Number one, to strengthen our own independent institutions, and number two, to educate the rest of the country and the world as to the contributions of African people.
So let me ask you this, because as opposed to even giving Stacey Dash and some of these other folks any more room about their conversation than we need to, how do we begin to even process the fact that learning history all year round, and sharing history all year round makes February actually more relevant.
Well, actually, there it is, Jeff. You just nailed it, brother. Just before he died in 1950, Carter Woodson wrote an editorial called No Study and Consequently No Celebration. He said, you don't talk about Black history only in February. In February, you detail what you learned in July, in January, in October. That's what we have to do. Ironically, Stacey Dash is not wrong. Carter G. Woodson would not disagree with this. He said, this isn't about the study of Negro history. It's about the study of the Negro in history. Mm-hmm. He said, once you put us back in, the case of Black people is well taken care of. Right. What Ms. Dash has revealed, however, is that she knows nothing about the history of African people. Mm-hmm. So she's saying, yes, we're Americans. Yeah, we're a lot more than that. We're the parents of everybody on the planet. And that includes the United States of America. But you have to learn that in May and June. You don't learn that in February. Woodson was so angry, finally. He said, I am so frustrated because he says, I see that they call for Negro orators during February to discuss the race problem and how it can be solved. That's the exact opposite of the purpose of Negro History Week then, you know, and Black History Month now.
Doc, if I could, before we go to break, real quick, I need you all to hear, she just doesn't listen at all, ever. It's like this is the Dr. Julianne Malvo show right now. Here's what I want y'all to do for me. Here's what I want y'all to do for me. Outside of, listen,
is the world. It is the universe. It is my foremothers and fathers, and yours, Jeff. We all have mothers and fathers. Mothers and fathers who have done this. My great
So here's what I need you to do. I need you all to think of who is the person in Black history you most admire that most people don't know about, and I want you to think about it, because now we've got a minute that we've lost. What are two things that you would recommend to Black families as ways to integrate the discussion of Black history into daily life?
Let's look to the founder, Carter Woodson. One of the first things Woodson did was tell Black people, learn your family history. So the first thing our Black families need to do is reconstruct. Go ask the oldest person in your family to talk about the oldest person they remember and make that child write it down. Not on a telephone, write it down. That's number one. Number two, quite frankly, is to share those stories in our institutions, Black churches, Black schools. And once that happens, I trust our people to do the rest.
Well, I was going to come back to you, but Dr. Malvo took the time. I would say read folks you've never read before.
Absolutely.
Shake Onto Diop.
Yes.
And people that will blow your mind, even if
Wallace, the first
absolutely.
Black woman to get a PhD.
Y'all, we're going to be right back with more from the Julianne Malvo show right after this.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
The Image Awards will air this Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern right here on TV One. All week, Roland's going to give his predictions on who will win with Danielle Belton, associate editor at The Root, April Rain, managing editor at BroadwayBlack.com, and Kelly Carter, senior writer for ESPN. ESPN's The Undefeated. Today, they break down predictions in the comedy categories.
Nominated for Outstanding Comedy Series, we have Blackish on ABC, House of Lies, Showtime, Key and Peele, Comedy Central, Orange is the New Black on Netflix, and Survivor's Remorse, which is on Stars. Who y'all got?
This is a really tough category because there's so many good people in it, but I'm going to go with Orange is the New Black, even though I kind of think it might go to Blackish.
I think that's right. Orange is the New Black is the one to beat, although Blackish is a family favorite.
No shocker here. Blackish is the smart money, but Orange is the New Black, probably most dynamic comedy series.
Orange is the New Black ain't going to win. I'm telling y'all right now, Black folks watch ABC. They like Anthony Anderson. They like Tracy Ellis Ross.
Yes.
Blackish is going to win this. They won it last year. Yeah. They're going to win it this year. And so you got to pay all the extra money to be on Netflix. ABC is free. I think Blackish is going to win this one. All right, folks, let's go to Outstanding Actor in a Comedy Series. Andre Brauer, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Anthony Anderson, Blackish, Don Cheadle, House of Lies, Dwayne Johnson, Ballers, Ronrico Lee, Survivor's Remorse.
Anthony Anderson,
hands
down, he wins. Yeah. He wins.
I think it goes to Anthony Anderson, although I would love to see Don Cheadle win because I think House of Lies is a really smart show that gets
I love House of Lies. Love
House of Lies is the best. And I want Don Cheadle to win as well, but I've accepted it's going to be Anthony.
Okay, first, which is shocking because Anthony, well, he was nominated, I think, 11 or 12 times and never won. He finally won last year. He's still mad because he only has one. I have two. So, Anthony, you might catch up to me. No, Anthony, because I'm actually nominated too, so we might win in our category. So I might still be up 3-2 on you. So we'll see what happens. So, yeah, I think Anthony's going to win this one.
Yeah.
And so finally, he'll be able to say he's a back-to-back winner. All right, outstanding actors in a comedy series, Gina Rodriguez, Jane the Virgin, Loretta Devine, The Carmichael Show, Tracy Ellis Ross, Black-ish, Uzo Aduba, Orange is the New Black, Wendy Raquel Robinson, The Game.
I think Uzo.
It's Uzo's year. I mean, we have her on Glenda the Good Witch on The Wiz. She's part of the fantastic ensemble that just won the SAG Award for Orange is the New Black. It's going to be her, hands down.
Who should win? Gina Rodriguez, to me. But I think who will win is Tracy Ellis Ross.
Okay, this one here is going to be between Tracy Ellis Ross and Wendy Raquel Robinson. Wendy Raquel Robinson, nope, she won her first. She was like the Susan Lucci on the female side of the Image Awards compared to Anthony Anderson on the male side. Mm-hmm. She finally won her first, I think it was last year. Mm-hmm. Year before last when she won her first. It's going to be between those two. The game, final season, of course, a lot of folks that were watching it, but also Tracy Ellis. And so based upon last year in terms of Anthony winning, Blackish winning, I think Tracy won last year as well. I think it's going to come down between those two. See, again, I think if you're talking about remember, you got NAACP members who are voting.
Right.
And again, I still go to when you have SAG Awards, when you have Golden Globe, that's a different voting crowd.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is more of a fan favorite.
Sure.
And so that's why I think people who are on Netflix are at a disadvantage compared to if you're on a broadcast show as well as a popular show like The Game was. And so we'll see what happens there. All right, supporting actor in the comedy series, David Alan Greer, The Carmichael Show, Lawrence Fishburne, Black-ish, Mike Epps, Survivor's Remorse, Miles Brown, Black-ish, Terry Crews, Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Who y'all got?
I want this one to go to David Alan Greer because I think he's a fantastic actor and he really carries the show along, but I think it is going to go to Lawrence Fishburne and Black-ish.
Lawrence Fishburne and Black-ish is going to win. I would love to see Mike Epps get some love because I think he's fantastic and great on Survivor's Remorse, but Lawrence Fishburne, Dap wins this one.
You know, I hope it's Mike Epps. I really enjoy him in Survivor's Remorse. I'm glad that he's back on the show. He's a phenomenal comedian. I hope he gets it.
What was the movie? Jumping the Broom? Mike Epps won an Image Award for Jumping the Broom. I think Mike Epps is also going to win this one here. I think he'll upset Lawrence Fishburne. Mike has a much stronger social media game. Lawrence is pretty much invisible. Also, you see Lawrence some on the show, but it's not like he's a constant every single week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the Carmichael Show, I think it's too new.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think too new. I think it hasn't been around. But so again, and plus, Mike has been part of the Black and Brown Get Down comedy tour all across the country as well. And so, in addition to Survivor's Remorse and to the comedy tour, you're talking about raising that game. So I think Mike Epps will win that category. All right, let's go to Outstanding Supporting Actress in the Comedy Series, Anna Deavere Smith, Nurse Jackie, Danielle Brooks, Orange is the New Black, Laverne Cox, Orange is the New Black, Marseille Martin, Black-ish, Tashina Arnold, Survivor's Remorse. Who you got?
I like Tashina Arnold.
I think that Danielle Brooks and Laverne Cox are going to fight it out because they're both on Orange New Black, so there's a place there for Marseille Martin to slip in from Black-ish and win it.
Interesting. Would love to see Laverne Cox win this one. I thought she had such a dynamic arc on the season this year. Critically, I think she stands out, but I love Danielle Brooks.
Yes.
And also love Little Diane from Black-ish.
Heavy hitters in this category.
I mean, this is a totally tough one. Yeah.
Marseille Martin wins this one.
Yeah.
First of all, she probably has the most gifts in terms of going around, in terms of her look, her constant.
Yeah.
Okay, so she, and again, she is an ultimate scene stealer on that show.
Agreed.
And so I think when, it's again, riding the Black-ish coattails.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you look at the numbers. African Americans watching a broadcast show compared to the others, that's huge there. And so I think she probably resonates more than Miles does in terms of in the male category. So I think plus she got a great last name. Of course she's gonna win it.
Well, yeah, we should have buried the lead.
Yeah, I don't know what y'all were thinking. I'm just saying. So I think, but again, no. So this might be a Black-ish Friday.
Yeah,
I can see it.
Yeah.
All right. All right, cool, folks. That's all the comedy categories. Again, don't forget, tune in to the NAACP Image Awards airing 9 p.m. Eastern right here on TV One. The red carpet is at 8 p.m. Eastern. I think I'm going to crash the red carpet. So let's see what ascot I'll be wearing this year. We'll see. What feather pocket square? You know,
it's got to be red, black, and green for Black History Month, right?
No. You can't. You can't go regular with me now. I'm going to hit you with a surprise there. So don't forget, 9 p.m. Eastern, Image Awards right here on TV One.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
It's birthday shout-out time. Retired receiver Donald Driver turns 41 years old. On this day in history, in 1897, Alfred Krall patents the ice cream scooper, becoming the first African-American to receive a patent in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In 1948, President Truman urges Congress to adopt a civil rights program, including fair employment, plus anti-lynching and anti-poll tax measures. And in 1988, James Weldon Johnson, composer of Lift Every Voice and Sing, is commemorated on a U.S. postage stamp. Tomorrow on News One Now, the latest on the Flint water crisis, plus more of Roland's predictions on who will win big at the NAACP Image Awards. You can follow me on Twitter at Jeff's Nation. You can also friend the show on the News One Now Facebook page. Go to newsone.com for the latest on the stories you care about. You all, I want to say thank you to all of our panelists that were here in the studio and on Skype. And I want to say this, as we come out of yesterday's rally in Flint, Michigan. What we've seen over the last 2 to 3 years is interesting moments in history where the national black community comes together around hashtags. And whether it was Trayvon Martin or whether it was Tamir Rice or the vast majority of Black Lives Matter, the difference between Flint and all of those is that this is not around one person, not around a shooting of one black man or the incarceration of one black woman. This is about the systematic abuse of an entire community of people. And if we're serious about it, a hashtag ain't gonna get it. It's just gonna lead us to the work that we gotta do. I'm out of here, y'all. I'll see you tomorrow.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.